Our culture has a great enthusiasm for youth. And some cultures, like the Chinese culture and in the Indian culture also, have a great respect for age. That the more elderly you become, the more you are considered wise. It isn't necessarily the truth. One of my friends, charmingly, when her mother was in the hospital dying, the woman said, "Dear, I always thought when I would get older, I would get wiser, but I didn't." Just put it just like that. So it isn't a guarantee merely to hold on to your body that your consciousness also expands. And sometimes in cultures that have too much reverence for age, their creativity is stifled, the freedom of the individual is stifled, the actual revelation of a truth is stifled. So it's not like I'm going to represent any particular idea over another in a cultural sense. But there is a fact that through the course of one lifetime, and even more profoundly over the course of many lifetimes, accepting reincarnation as a self-evident necessity, if we're going to reach a level of understanding that's more than mediocre, whether or not you resist the idea of reincarnation or not, some of you who may be coming here for the first time may have to think these ideas out. I certainly find it a comfort. Others, we look around and we think how much we can accomplish or how little we can accomplish in one lifetime. And the prospect of being limited to what you can learn in 40 or 50 or 60 or 70 or 80 years is really kind of scary. You know, I recall I was engaged in a very complex way with one of my aged relatives toward the end of his life. And my thought was, well, let's try to get as much enlightenment into this system as possible before you exit from this body. And in my way of understanding, you have to start all over with the baby's body and just bring yourself back to here. So I was pushing perhaps a little harder than I should have pushed to try to get clarity. And at one point, I was engaged in what could only be a struggle of will against my desire to have this understanding be accepted and his desire to have it not be accepted. And I said, "Don't you want to understand?" And he very honestly said, "No," just like that. "No." He said, "That's quite enough to cope with what I already know," he said. And essentially then he said, "I'm just trying to make it through to the end." And shortly after that, and I was quite charmed by this, I hope you understand me properly, he went sort of senile and then had a little vacation for a couple of years before he left his body. He just decided that enough was enough. And he just checked out, became very sweet, rather childlike, and just kind of played at being a child in an old man's body, became very, very dear, and then finally breathed his last. Another aged relative of mine is fulfilling that curse that mothers sometimes put on their children. If you keep making an expression like that, your face is going to get stuck. You know, child experiments with their face getting stuck. Well, in this particular gentleman, he's experimented with wrong attitudes a long, long time. And now that his brain is old, his brain has gotten stuck in some of these wrong attitudes. And one of the things he particularly loves to do is rehash the things that he's angry about. Mostly angry about the things that other people's stupidity. He really likes to, you know, review other people's stupidity as opposed, of course, to his great intelligence. So he gets to rehash these stories over and over, and I have tried to prevent him from doing it, which is not well met, just makes him more determined to tell the story. So finally, I just now just sit back and listen to the story again. As one of my friends said, "I guess there's something I haven't learned yet about this story, so I think I'll hear it again." And after he told me some long tale and got very agitated about how so-and-so was such a moron and so on like this, and after it had all passed away, I said to him, "Do you enjoy just going over and over again the things that make you angry?" He looked at me as if I were stupid, and he said, "Yes," just like that. Oh, okay. I laughed. I thought, well, I'm not going to keep trying to persuade you not to, because, you see, he got energy from doing that. This made him feel sort of alive. He was repeating the pattern that he'd found satisfactory all through his life, which is everyone is dumb but me, and these are all the ways in which they're dumb, and therefore look how bright I am. And from my point of view, it was a horror story, because what you see locking him into is this unlearned lesson that far from repudiating that ignorance, he's squeezing it all the tighter. So the reward for that is, well, as one popular philosopher said, the reward for clinging to your delusions is, guess what? You get to keep them. That's all. Nothing else happens to us except we get to keep living on whatever plane of consciousness we want to live on. There is an element of, I'll reach that in a moment, but it's a very free universe in a certain sense, which is there are all these stratas of consciousness. I mean, just look around. Just look what a wide variety of human beings there are. Swami Kriyananda often remarks, two eyes, a nose, and a mouth, and just look what God has done with it. It's just remarkable to just look around and see. Sometimes I've played in the mirror, just making like different expressions out of this face. You know, if this face had been perpetually angry, you can just see if you make an expression how the whole face will begin to shift into something else. You see people toward the end of their lives. I've heard the common wisdom that you have until the age of 40, the face that God made for you, and after the age of 40, you have the one you made for yourself, which is to say what your habitual consciousness is. The marks of age come to all bodies, unless we're Babaji or some great yogi who for some reason remains eternally youthful, which there aren't many of those. The rest of us, just time passes and the cells go through whatever they go through, and well, this is what happens, you know, what we're all looking at. But the underlying consciousness behind it is formed by the habits of our own mind. And there's a lot of wisdom in mothers saying, if you keep making that expression, your face is going to get stuck that way. And even more profoundly, in my relationships with my older relatives, if you keep thinking those thoughts, your brain is going to get stuck there. My elderly uncle has been an extremely spine-stiffening spiritual lesson inadvertently because his brain has gotten stuck and in a place that fortunately mine doesn't go that often, but mine has its own places where it goes, where it kind of, you know, gets in like this and begins to think about all the things that were done wrong to me. And you know, just it's the pleasure of scratching a mosquito bite, isn't it? Just to kind of go into that geologic strata in which I get to indulge my ego and everything's okay because you're a little icky and you're a little icky, but I'm not icky, you know. Or it would have come out better except that they didn't really treat me right, and it's always the way of those people to treat me like that, isn't it? And I could have been a champion, but, you know, except for all these little things that happen. There's a story and there's a line in the movie Pride and Prejudice, Jane Austen, the very old original movie, the original black and white, where the very haughty aunt, the young girl's playing the piano beautifully, and the haughty aunt says, I too could have been a great pianist if I'd ever learned to play. But is it really so different? I could have been so successful, except that I wasn't. You know, I could have been so happy, except I never really chose happiness. I could have been so beautiful, but I never made my consciousness what it should have been. You know, this is the reality of the life that we face. We are the result of all the choices that we've made. And we have this constant, ongoing reality in which we simply reap what we have sown again and again and again and again. And we very often don't like the harvest of what we've done. You know, we just didn't realize when we were doing it what the consequences would be. How many times have we just tried to cut corners? When my mother sent me out to learn to sew when I was 10 years old. My teacher was Mrs. Taylor, one of those fortunate names. So Mrs. Taylor taught me to sew when I was 10 years old. And we would meet up in the second story of the Singer Sewing Machine Company building. And me and her and some other little groups of kids would learn to sew things. And it was one of those few things from my childhood that actually stuck with me, that I enjoyed, and I actually learned how to do it. And like many children, when I first started, I was reluctant to put out the amount of energy that was required. And it became for me a kind of mirror for many other karmic things, because I learned in the process of assembling a little dress that I wanted to make, my first little green cotton dress that had little white cuffs and this little white collar and the zipper up the back, that every time I just got to some critical point of sewing and I decided, oh, I just won't really put out the energy to conscientiously pin, every little aspect of it. I'll just kind of cram it together and run it through the sewing machine. And of course, then you would pick it up and it would all be fine, except for the place where you kind of crammed it together and stuck it through the sewing machine. And I began to learn from that very simple project of sewing, because cause and effect was so obvious. If I applied my mind with conscientious care, did it step by step in the way that was needed, the results would reflect it. And insofar as I tried to put out less energy, get something for nothing, force the issue when the issue wasn't going to be forced, not go back and repair my mistakes, then basically the garments had to be thrown away, because they would never come out right. It was like, for me, my first spiritual lesson was from Mrs. Taylor in the Singer Sewing Building, because that was when I first began to learn about karma. And so all of us are living in this result of our past far more profoundly than we realize, because really, mercifully, God doesn't make us remember everything we did. I mean, it's painful enough to just remember the things of this incarnation when you reflect on it. How many of us, you know, have these points of regret, points of disappointment? If only I had done this, why did I do that? Seemed like a good idea, but what could I have been thinking? You know, it's a great effort spiritually to purge our mind of that kind of second guessing. Imagine if you had all your incarnations to think about. I mean, you've had millions of incarnations. No one would ever get out of bed. We would just be so overwhelmed by the weight of it. So fortunately, God takes our bodies away, and with that, he takes away the memory cells. And we may have feelings about things and inclinations, but at least the details are gone. But what we're working with at all times is we're working with these dual forces playing against us. And one half of us, one part of us at least, has this intuitive awareness of what the potential of this incarnation may be. And whatever we define that as, we might call it money, we might call it any whatever, but we have this potential for self-expansion. And the other part of us has this habit of thinking either, oh, it's much too difficult to try, I don't really want to put out the energy, there's more pleasure in just hiding, if I don't make an effort, then I'll never really have failed. All the whole long, incredible long story that fights against this natural inclination to expand. That's what karma is about. Is God calling the soul home, the soul itself desperately seeking this self-expansion, and then all the habits of fear and longing and holding on and hoping something else will be true. We spend so much time in our lives just trying to assert truths that just aren't truths. Like my aged relative saying to me, I don't want to really know anymore. I know enough, no more for me. As if it was actually possible to just close our eyes and stop the soul's desire to expand. He dropped out for a little while, took a little vacation, you know, just dropped out from the problems of life. I think a lot of dementia becomes that. It's just like, enough is enough. I've had enough of this world. I'm just going to play for now and let someone take care of me. I watched him just take a little holiday. Then the body went away and he got to start over again. How much do we do that without formally going demented? You know, we just pretend we're just not going to deal with it. But sooner or later, our souls will never be satisfied until they really have that perfect freedom which is our own. I was reflecting with a friend just yesterday. She had this kaleidoscope, one of those really beautiful ones that are made like art pieces. You hold it up and the light comes in from the side, and as you spin it, I guess it's stones and gemstones, and they just form pattern after pattern, each one just more exquisitely beautiful than the one before. And just before that, I'd heard Swami Kriyananda say in a talk he was giving or something he had recorded, he said, he spoke of joy, joy, almost unbearable joy. And you think, how could joy be unbearable? It was an odd combination when you think about it. I'm looking at this kaleidoscope, and it was so beautiful that there was this almost unbearable longing to be able to merge into that beauty. Unbearable in the sense because there's this feeling of hitting the wall of some inner limitation that enables you to see that beauty, but not really to make it everything a part of you. And I thought of a very mundane example of that same reality. There's a beautiful fabric store, speaking of sewing, over in Los Altos. It's called it's Exotic Silks or Thai Silk, something like that. And it's mostly silk fabric, and the prices are not too high in there. And the fabrics are so beautiful, and the colors are so rich that when I go into that store, I actually become just a little inebriated with the color. And you sort of go up to these big tubes of cloth, and I have to resist the desire to climb into the bins, you know, and just kind of drape myself in the fabric or embrace them as if they were living things. And then what comes over you, and I realize this must be what comes over people all the time. I want to buy it all and take it home, right? Because what I'm really longing for, what it reminds me of, it reminds me of the astral world. It reminds me of the freedom not merely to see with the senses, but to experience with the consciousness. In Autobiography of a Yogi, Master describes how in the higher astral realms, you can experience beauty through all your senses simultaneously. You can taste with your eyes. You can hear with your tongue. You know, you can feel things with your ears. In other words, all of we're so limited in the physical body. We can just, it's all second hand. We see it and we try to take it in. We hear it and we try to take it in. But it's never really satisfying. It's never really enough. We can try as hard as we can, but it's never enough until we actually merge our consciousness into that actual vibration. And this is the reason, you know, so many people get so tired of hearing Swami Kriyananda say and other spiritual teachers say, you will never be satisfied by the things of this world. And there's this sort of defiant sense that says, yes, I will. You know, because we don't want what little we have to be taken away from us. That's how it sounds. We've gotten our little tiny morsel of human love. We have our little morsel of financial security, or a little morsel of a happy, nice little house where we live. And then Swami says, everything in the end just goes up and down and comes to zero. And you say, no, 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 like this. I always remember the little boy who was brought up to be blessed here, and he was in the arms of his father, and he really just didn't want it. He put his hands over his spiritual eye. I was trying to bless him. He put his hands over his spiritual eye, and he begins to say very loudly, no, 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 like that. And so it is, you know, that the scriptures and the masters tell us, you will only find satisfaction in God. The things of this world will not satisfy you. And a few people say, yes, yes. But most of us say, no, no. Because what little bit we have, we think we're going to lose. Isn't that so? But still, so deeply, how difficult it is to find a deep sense of eternal peace, isn't it? That song that Karen sang for us, John Anderson, it's a beautiful Scottish poem. You know, this couple, when they met, they were young. They lived their life together. Many a lively day, John, we've had with one another. Then the lines are, now we must totter down, John. And you see the old couple, and hand in hand we'll go and sleep together at the foot. John Anderson, my love. It's such a, isn't it dear, that song? Sometimes it's just impossible to hear it or sing it without weeping. Because it really does describe that intense longing for a kind of enduring love that even death can't take away. And the reason that song is so moving and that melody is so moving is not because it says, oh yes, yes, you will find your perfect partner and you will live together and early death will not separate you and you will be able to just have it just exactly you want. That's not really why that song touches us so deeply. What touches us so deeply is that it transcends those limitations. Some part of that melody goes beyond the subject, goes way beyond the subject and awakens that it's a bittersweet quality. That's where Swami speaks of the unbearable joy. Until that is fulfilled, deeply fulfilled in divine oneness, we live in this sort of in-between place. The chant that I was singing at the beginning, one that I like so much, you know. When I die, look into mine eyes. They will mutely say, I will be thine always. You know, it's like this contest that we're in, this contest against our own karma. And our own karma is always saying to us, take the easy road. That's what they say, but how do you really know? Yes, of course, you should be devoted to God, but you can also do all these other things. This is a balanced age, you know? Just a little bit of ego, you know? Just sort of whispering in our ears like that. And we listen, and we live that way, and we just try it again, and again, and again, and again. No one can hurry it. That's where the Gita talks about the karma, the lovely three kinds of karma that there is. Some karma is just a very slight misunderstanding. Oh, for a moment there, I had a selfish thought. You blow, the smoke was obscuring the fire. You just go like that, and then the clarity of divine love shows. You know, the great saints are like this. Saint Bernadette of Lourdes, who had visions of Divine Mother when she was just a little girl, and died in her early 20s. She's a very, very saintly person in the Catholic tradition. And on her deathbed, she was thinking of things that made her so sad. Oh, my mother worked so hard, and she gave me, we had so little money. This is true of Bernadette's life. And she gave me this onion soup, and I was not grateful for it. And then she wept tears. She was so sad for that little bit of selfishness that it obscured. Her heart was so pure like that. One of my friends, Paula, died of cancer. And there was 3 days when she knew that it was the end of her life. But she lived for 3 days. And we had this big party in the hospital. There was about 35 or 40 of us in the hospital with her for these 3 days and nights. Well, we called it Paula's passing party. We were just there, just enjoying her. And she was gradually finishing all her business. And she called up different people, and people would come in, and she was a very saintly person, just sort of making it right with everyone in a very honest way. She'd had this falling out with one woman friend, and the woman friend had been awful, and Paula had actually behaved appropriately, but nonetheless the other woman's friend's feelings had been hurt. And Paula was always sorry about that. So she got her on the phone and she said, with perfect honesty, I've always felt so badly that your feelings were hurt. I've always felt so badly that disharmony came between us. She never said that she was wrong, Paula. She just said, I always felt so badly that there was this disharmony. And then in her way she said, but I think we're both big enough gals to put it behind us. Don't you think so? Perfect honesty, but making a perfect bridge. And in fact, she did bridge that. And then when just the last days there, it was just a small thing. Paula had cancer intermittently. This was her third round over a decade. And periodically she would try to do things to make herself healthy, but she had a great passion for coffee. And on the last day of her life, David went down and bought her a cappuccino just the way she liked it. And she held it in her hand the last day of her life. She couldn't even eat anything, but she would dip the swab in and sort of put it around her mouth like that. And when she was going out, she started to tell David, you know, I like it. And David so sweetly looked at her and said, I know how you like your coffee, Paula. So she had this coffee cup in her hand, and in the last hours of her life, she kept fading in and out. And someone tried to take the coffee out of her hand. And she woke up and clutched it. She said, I'm not done with it yet, like that. Just so dear. But finally, when she was really ready to go, she put it down. We sort of knew it was really, we literally knew it was her last hours because she put down the coffee. But after she'd done everything, we were saying to her, well, Paula, is there anything left? And there had been this man named, he was called PJ by his initials, PJ. And she and he had been very close, but they'd also had a falling out at one point. And then he had been killed, and so she couldn't speak to him now. And she said, well, once I was really mad at PJ, And when he sent me a rose bush, I didn't plant it for a whole month. We all looked at each other and thought, oh Lord, please, can I die with just that on my conscience? You know, some karma's like that. It's just very light, just a puff like that. But other karma, as it says, is more like rust on a mirror. Now talking about a silver mirror that has to be cleaned. It's an old-fashioned image. And you can get that rust off, but you have to keep rubbing and rubbing and rubbing and rubbing. And then you look at it and it's not quite clean and you have to rub and you have to rub again. You know, there's some inclinations within us that are so deep-seated that have served us in some way so well that they're like that. But we just have to keep rubbing, you know. But what good will it do us to stop? If we stop, that clear light is completely obscured. We may decide, I'm tired of scrubbing. I don't want to know anymore. I'm just going to go senile for a few years, and maybe it'll be easier when I'm a baby. You know, we'll start over again, but you're just going to be born with all that same rust right on that mirror. You may be born in, you know, as a Bedouin in the desert somewhere, but your consciousness is going to be exactly where it was. It'll just be reflecting something different, and you're going to have to pick up that tool and just keep scrubbing that mirror. That's what we work with most of the time. And the third kind of karma, so sweetly described, it's like a baby in the womb, which is, it's not going to come out until it's ready. In other words, we're going to have to carry it around until it really finishes. Nothing we can do can hurry that. The art of being successful on the spiritual path, quite truly, is this very deep-seated, calm acceptance of this process, that this is who we are. You know, we hear about how great we can be, but we also have to understand that that's our potential. It's this razor's edge we walk, which was never for a moment losing confidence and faith in that absolute certainty of our divine goodness, and also working extremely realistically with all the different kinds of karma that affect us now, and never allowing any of that to depress or discourage us. It's a tall order, you know? But in honest truth, what choice do we have? You see? That's the point we have to come to in our lives. We have to realize that it doesn't really make any difference what the road ahead looks like, because the road behind us is no place we ever want to go. Whatever effort we've gotten up to this point of awareness, the only possible thing we can do from here is go forward. And whether the karma is blowing like smoke, cleaning the mirror, or just outlasting it, you know, if we just keep putting one foot in front of the other, with that deep design, divine understanding, with that faith, with that truth, that God is our own nature. And sooner or later, the joy will become so unbearable that we will release whatever holds us back, and it will become bearable in the most beautiful sense. Master says, where is it on the wall here? Enjoyable beyond imagination of expectancy. Isn't that an extraordinary phrase? What a great use of English. Speaking of cosmic consciousness when it comes. Whatever we have imagined of bliss that can be ours, it will be enjoyable beyond even our imagination to expect it. What a promise. God bless.